Well, it just says here, Sri Jamila Vacha. So okay. He's one of the, yeah, Jamila explains the incarnation of Godhead, the King Nimi. So it's the different Nadi Kendras are going through and answering all these questions. So he asked, in the beginning of this chapter, he was asking them to explain the incarnations of Godhead. And so we see through this chapter various incarnations are going to be explained. And the first one, I think, is Narayana Rishi, who's also understood to be manifestations of
Krishna and Arjuna.
Yeah, Krishna and Arjuna. Krishna explains that to Arjuna in the Gita. He says, you know, many, many births in the past that you and I have taken. I can remember all of them, but you can remember none. So what's this explaining to us? Krishna says, I can remember all, but you can remember none. What's that explaining? Huh? What's the difference? Yeah. Simply put, one is God, one is Jiva. Because Jiva changes body constantly. And this is the point that Krishna's making. He said, you know, we've been in many births together, I can remember all of them. So what does that indicate? It means he's infallible. It means he's not affected by the change of the body. Whereas we see Arjuna says that you can't remember them. Why? Because you're a Jiva. The Jiva can't remember the change of the body. This is what happens. Death is like we become overwhelmed by the influence of material nature. And the senses become, you know, actually new senses there. Whereas when Krishna, when he goes from one body to the next, you know, as it says, Atasi Krishna Navadi Navadi Gayamadi Seva Mukhiti Vasayami Svarati Adaha. You know, Krishna has his transcendental nature, his name, form, quality, pastimes. They're all completely transcendental, not affected. You know, when he has different manifestations, when he goes from one incarnation to another, not that it's changed or he becomes covered by ignorance or anything like that, because they're transcendental. So when Krishna appears, he appears in his original transcendental form. It's not like he's forced to take birth like an ordinary living entity. That's one of the points that's being brought out here, or we'll see brought out here. The Lord, when he appears in various incarnations, it's not like he's forced into a womb. As it's described in the third canto, how this is that the jiva is pushed into a womb through the particle of sin. No choice. You can say, oh no, I don't want that one, I want this one. It's not like you go to the supermarket and you pick all the different brands or whatever brand you like. Oh, I'll have this brand of body, I don't want that brand of body. No, you're forced. Because of, as it says, I don't remember the verse, but it describes it due to the past activities of the jiva, then this body is determined due to those activities. So whatever activities we perform in this life, Krishna explains the same thing in the 8th chapter of the Gita. Yam yam bhakisman bhavam kajati yam yukadeva kumpameva kipatana sattha bhavadana. So, you know, whatever state of consciousness the person achieves at the moment of death, then that state they achieve in the next body without fail. So the living entity is performing various activities. These activities produce karma, they also produce a particular type of consciousness. You know, one performs simple activities, and they develop a simple consciousness. They perform pious activities, they develop a pious consciousness. This is explained very nicely by Rupa Goswami in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the Nectar Devotion. And he describes how, by performing, you know, there's a seed, kutam, which is there in the heart. This come from activities we perform in the past. And this seed then manifests, and from this manifest, you know, actually, kutam is the desire, call it bijam. Then it turns into kutam, and then from that it manifests as various activities, and then from these activities they produce further desire, and also one of the other effects is karma. We get a reaction. So this is the cycle of the karma, and this accrues within the jiva, and then this determines, this pushes us in a certain direction. As Kapila Devi explains the Devi, so karma, according to the karma, according to the activities, Deva, and under the supervision of the divine, then the jiva achieves a particular type of body. So that's how it's working for us, but for Krishna, it's not like that. The Supreme Person of Godhead is not like that. He manifests in his form out of his desires. It's not the way, you know, we may have desires, But we can't choose a particular form because of, you know, because we have desires. Well, you know, I want to be born a demigod, I want to be born this, I want to be born that. You know, so it's kind of funny that sometimes when you're speaking to guests, etc., about you know, reincarnation, karma, stuff like that, and you talk about, you know, like you perform activities like this, you take birth as a dog. I said, well, I think a dog's life would be pretty good. Okay, well, you may get that opportunity to take birth as a dog. But you can't determine what type of dog or where that dog's going to be. Maybe you're a dog in a country where they eat dogs. Yeah, you wind up being someone's dinner. Not like, you know, a pampered dog here in the West, you know, where they get to eat, you know, ice cream and steaks and all this kind of stuff. You know, maybe you won't be that kind of dog. Maybe you will be a dog, you know, like, I just come back from India and you see the dogs there, they're all very, very mangy, they've got all this like skin disease and the hair's all falling out. They're very, very unfortunate position to be in. You know, very, very difficult position. It's not a very pleasant birth. But they just have, you know, they have one idea. There's an interesting story Prabhupada tells, you know, about, because like people are very much influenced by their environment and their circumstances, and they're very, you know, very narrow in their vision. And they just see their environment, they don't see much more than that. And there's a story Prabhupada tells to support this concept. I forget what they call them, but they have these people in various parts of India where there's canals, and they pull the boats down the canals. They have a rope and they pull the boats. So there's this one, I think it's a tailor they call him. There's one man who does his job, and he's just sort of daydreaming there, and he's thinking, you know, if I ever become wealthy, then I'll light the path with pillows so that when I'm pulling the boat, I don't hurt my feet. Yeah, so he can't think outside of this reality. You know, he can't think outside of his life. Yeah? So in the same way, like people, when they're thinking like that, they're thinking, well, you know, it wouldn't be bad being a dog. Maybe in Australia, though, the dog's life might be a nice life, but in another country, like you go to China, or you go to, you know, even India, you go to various parts of India. And I remember being in, I think it was Hyderabad, and they sell goats there because people eat goats. And one of the things they do is, because a goat's body and a dog's body look very similar, so one of the things they do is they leave the hair on the legs, you know, on the what we call the lower part of the leg, the foot and the ankle, that so you can tell whether it's a dog or a goat, because some people are selling dog meat and people are eating it. Yeah. So, you know, in that type of circumstance, that would be so pleasant. But anyhow, we see here how the demigods are praising the Supreme Lord, and the Lord, because, you know, his body is fully transcendental, and as it describes in the the personality of God is perfect and complete. And even though so many perfect and complete units emanate from him, they're just coming out of his body. He doesn't have to go to Bunnings and buy bits and pieces and make the furniture and all that kind of stuff. It just comes out of his body. As he's got Parashya Shakti Vividaya Shrute, so many different energies, multifarious energies, they just manifest from his body. And he doesn't become diminished in any way because of that manifestation. It's just like, you know, if we were to do a lot of exercise, very, very hard exercise, if we didn't have sufficient energy in our body to do that, then what happens is the muscles start to become depleted. Actually, the muscles get eaten away. You know, because we don't have a transcendental body. We have a body made of matter, and it has limitations. Whereas a transcendental body, especially a transcendental body like the Lord's, has no limitations. A lot of people struggle to understand that, how Krishna's body is completely perfect, and there's absolutely no limit to what he does. And Srila Prabhupada often says that all these other religionists are actually impersonalists. Whether it's the Christians, the Muslims, whatever, they're all impersonalists because they don't actually understand the nature of Krishna. And it's a difficult thing to understand, because, again, it gets back to this concept of Atmavan Manyate Jagat. As I think, that's the way everything is. And we have this experience of a limited, material, you know, very, very finite body. We may think we're infinite sometimes out of false ego or out of pride. We may think that there's nothing I can't do. Yet, when we actually put it to the test, when we actually try to do things, we have the experience that we're limited. Therefore, everything we perceive is in conditioned by this limited perception. It's like, how can God be unlimited? Because I'm also limited. It's just like, you know, some religions say, I mean, the view that, you know, they have this understanding that, you know, well, God is about us, and God is this, and God is that, and you know, because His name is so, you know, spiritual, and so that we actually can't say His name because we're putting some limitation on Him. They have all these different concoctions because really they don't understand the nature of God. Factually speaking, it's not possible to completely understand the nature of God. We can partially understand. We can understand the concept. We can understand the principles behind. But to fully understand Krishna is not possible, because Krishna is unlimited. And it's described in Ananta Shesh. He has unlimited malice. You can imagine, you know, having unlimited malice. And he's constantly describing the glories of the Lord with those unlimited malice. And he never repeats the same thing twice. Nor does he ever come to an end of the glories of Krishna. So this is the nature of Krishna, which is completely unlimited. And for him to manifest, you know, because you know, Cupid had tried to bewilder Narayana Rishi with all these beautiful girls. You know, because Indra was concerned about it. It's kind of interesting, Indra does this quite a bit. He gets very, very concerned about his position. And this is quite typical of people in this material world. It's like they have a position, and whenever they see anyone who could even be remotely, this is obviously referring to people who are materially attached, because someone who's not materially attached is not going to manifest these types of qualities. But we see that by people in this material world, when they're materially attached to their position, to their opulences, to whatever it is they have, you know, when they're attached to these things, as soon as they see someone coming along who represents a potential threat, not even someone who is a threat, but you know, as soon as someone comes along who represents a potential threat, immediately they're going to defend them. They try to protect their position, they try to protect their opulence, they try to protect their whatever it is they have. And generally speaking, when they do these types of things, when they get into this protecting mode, they perform different types of activities which further implicate them in this material world. So this thing, as soon as we start acting to further our position in the material world, we, you know, we're acting on the platform of false ego. And as Krishna says, if we don't hear his instructions, but rather we act on the false ego, actually be lost, everything will be destroyed because of this acting on the platform of false ego. But then he says, if you act according to my instructions, you will come to Sada Durvani. He says, you'll overcome all the obstacles of conditioned life by my grace. Doesn't he explain to Arjuna, by your power? He says, by my grace, you overcome all the obstacles of conditioned life. But we see, you know, Cupid, he's like, Indra is attached to his position. He's the king of the demigods, which is, you know, it's not like being the president of America or something like that. It's a very, very big position. And he has so much wealth. But because he's materially attached, he's so attached to maintaining that position. And he's done so many things that have got him into very, very difficult situations. You know, we see in the Krishna book, you know, the 10th canto, how he was trying to destroy the residents of Vrindavan. Because Indra stopped the yagya that they were doing for him. We see also that when Prithu Maharaj was performing yagya, that he came and disrupted the final yagya, he took on the guise of the sannyasi. And Prabhupada explains in the purport there how because he actually was a false sannyasi, it's Indra has actually corrupted the renounced order of life by this presenting himself as a sannyasi. And you see, you know, when you go to holy places, you'll see many people dressed as sannyasis who actually don't have the appropriate qualifications. They're not renounced at all. And sometimes you'll even see, you know, these so-called sadhus. You can go to various holy places and see so-called sadhus smoking beads, drinking tea, you know, having connections with women, all types of things like that. Prabhupada explains, interestingly, he says, there is a class of women who would like to go, because they understand, they have some piety, and they understand that if I can have a child, and they have desires of a child. They want to have a good child, a spiritual child, because they understand that if I have my child is spiritually advanced, then the child will take me back up to Godhead. So they have some piety, they have some understanding of the spiritual process. But the lack of determination to carry through a process on their own. So they have this belief that if I have a child to a sannyasi, then this child will be this child will be a great devotee, and then that child will be able to deliver me back home to Godhead. So they go to the Dharma, they go to the holy places, looking for such a sannyasi to have a child to. So that's one side of the story. The other side of the story, which I find very interesting, is there is a class of men who understand that women are doing this. So they dress themselves up as sannyasis and they go to Vrindavan and Mayapur or a place like this, looking for these women so they can enjoy the sex with them. So you see, it's like Raya Maharaj says, the cheaters and the cheated. They're looking to be cheated in one way or another. Just like, I was listening to a class some time ago, and this Rupa was explaining how someone was complaining about how at the airport they bought this Rolex watch, and it wasn't actually a Rolex, they got ripped off. And then he was explaining, but how much did they pay for a Rolex? $200. So you can understand that, Rolex watches cost thousands of dollars. So if you're happy to buy a Rolex watch for $200, that means you're cheating, because either it's stolen or it's false. And if you think that's okay, then you're a cheater, and you'll get cheated. But a person who's actually looking for the real deal, as they say, wouldn't buy such a thing like that, because they know it's probably stolen or it's not true. So anyhow, as we were saying, people with mature desires, they perform so many impious and simple activities to try to maintain their position. And this is exactly what Indra's done. He's engaged Cupid here to try to distract Narayana Rishi from his austerities, because he's thinking, why is he doing that? Because he's thinking that Narayana Rishi are just ordinary people, there's an ordinary living entity. He's thinking he's just an ordinary jiva, and that I am more powerful than him, and therefore I can bewilder him by my different arrangements. Same with Krishna and Rishi Vrindavan. He was thinking that they are just ordinary persons. He didn't actually understand who it was he was dealing with. And this is a living entity, bewildered by the influence of false ego. Krishna explains this. He says, Prakriti Kriyamana Gunai Kamrasava Shahantaravi Manapata Hamati Manate. He bewildered by the influence of false ego. He carries out so many different activities, thinking that he's the doer. So here we see that Indra is thinking that I am actually the enjoyer here, I'm the supreme enjoyer. And he's directing Cupid to engage in this trying to bewilder Narayana Rishi. And what happens is Cupid manifests all these attractive women, trying to distract Narayana Rishi from their meditation. And what happens is when he realizes that I haven't read this story for a long time, so I'm not completely clear on it, but when he realizes that Narayana Rishi is, he's actually very, very sorry for what he's done. But Narayana Rishi is not at all effective. He's saying, please come to my ashram, he offers him gifts and this thing and that thing, etc. And then here we see here now how he's manifesting so many beautiful women out of his body. And it's saying here, it says, Ati Adbhuta. So Adbhuta is astonishing. This is there's that prediction by Nityananda Guru, how there's going to be this Adbhuta Mandir in Mayapur. And it's like astonishingly beautiful temple. Not just an ordinary building, it's going to be Adbhuta. So we see here that these women are being described as astonishingly gorgeous, decorated with clothes and ornaments, and all faithfully engaged in the Lord's service. So rather than trying to be engaged in distracting the minds of others, we see Cupid has brought these apsaras, etc., to try to distract the mind of Narayana Rishi. No, these women are just faithfully engaged in the service of the Lord, so they're not acting in a way to distract other people's minds. And so this is all obviously all very astonishing to Cupid and his followers. Read the purport. Lord Narayana showed his causeless mercy toward the demigods by relieving them of their false prestige. Although the demigods were proud of their personal beauty and female companions, the Lord showed that he was already being adequately served by innumerable gorgeous females, each of whom was far more beautiful than any female companion imagined by the demigods. So we see here that even though that they've tried to distract the mind of Narayana Maharishi and actually committed an offense against the Supreme Person of Godhead, he's not at all bothered by it, one thing. And then he's bestowing his mercy upon them by helping them overcome their false ego. I was listening to a class yesterday. Actually, the story, there's a whole lot of stories on the latest version of Prabhupada's lectures and stuff from the Bhagavad Archives. They've compiled one CD, which is just all different stories that they've pulled out of Prabhupada's lectures, conversations, etc. There's one story there that's talking about, who was it? I can't remember. Anyway, someone was approaching Krishna. Oh, that's right, yeah. It's interesting, very interesting story. There was this one thief, and he was listening to a discussion about Krishna and Vrindavan. It was some sort of Kshatana. And so they were describing how Krishna lives in Vrindavan and he's a counterboy. And every day his mother dresses him up with all these valuable, beautiful jewels, worth so much money. And then she sends him out into the field to take care of the cows. And this thief is thinking, well, this is very good, because he's just a little boy, and I can easily go and steal all these jewels. So he decides he goes to Vrindavan. And he makes a great endeavor, he's traveled a long way, and then he's there in Vrindavan, he's very ardently looking for Krishna, he's putting so much energy in, he's looking everywhere for Krishna, always his mind just absorbed in, where's Krishna, where's Krishna? Doesn't know Krishna's God or anything like that, he's just absorbed in, where's Krishna? And so then finally he sees Krishna, and he thinks, oh, very nice, I found him at last, and then he goes to Krishna, and he says, he said, I'd like to take all your jewels. And Krishna says, no, you can't do that. Because my mother would be very angry. And then so but he's still got this desire that I want all these jewels from Krishna. He's like, think about this. And then in the process of being, absorbed in Krishna, and because he's actually received the darshan of Krishna, he actually becomes purified. Because it's the nature of Krishna. He's completely pure. And then anyone who comes into contact with the Supreme Pure automatically becomes pure. So this thief, he becomes purified, and he actually gives up this desire. And then Krishna says, you can have the jewels, whatever you want. And he says, no, I don't want to take your jewels. You need to become purified with your pure desire. So in the same way we see here, it's been described, that these demigods, the Cupid and his followers, have become purified by this contact with Krishna. And they give up false ego, because the false ego is what causes us. Just like we see Indra, he's defending his position. And it's interesting that he didn't get that mercy in his pastime. He didn't get the mercy of Krishna's association. Whereas those that he sent to distract Narayana Rishi, they got the mercy of Narayana Rishi. They actually, they were benedicted to give up all false ego. And this is actually, one of the great goals of devotional service, is actually overcome the influence of false ego. Because as Krishna, as mentioned before, Krishna describes in the Gita, that it is if we act out of false ego, we will be lost. We'll be cast adrift in this material world because we're acting out of false ego. And it's only when we're doing activities for no other purpose than to satisfy Krishna, not to push forward our own goals, not to sort of develop our own empire, whatever it is. Only when we're doing activities that are there meant to satisfy Krishna, and we're not acting out of false ego. That means 100% for Krishna's pleasure. Can't be 80% for Krishna, 20% for me, or whatever percentage you want to work at. 100% for Krishna, that means no false ego. Because the false ego comes from the concept of the body, that I am this body, and everything related to this body is mine. So, I want to improve my position, I want to have more money, I want this, I want that, I want. And it's all about just the self. And this is false ego. This is this ahankara. I am this body. Because if we have this concept that I am this body, everything is related to this body, then we're doing all the things to try to satisfy that concept. But as soon as we can understand that I am not this body, what is the next understanding? I am an eternal servant of Krishna. Therefore, taking this understanding to heart, actually understanding what it means to be a servant, means that I do everything for the satisfaction of Krishna. And as soon as I'm not doing something for the satisfaction of Krishna, it means I've given up this concept of service and I start to think I'm the master in whatever way. So we need to really firmly understand that. That's why this process of devotional service is very effective, because it helps us to firmly understand my position. Gopipata Papa Kamala Dasa Dasa Anudasa, that I'm nothing but a servant, a servant, a servant of the lotus feet of the Master of Gopis, who is the cause of universal personal bliss and his existence of beliefs. Krishna's position is just inconceivable. His position is just so, so much more elevated than our position. But the problem is, we think, this Vimukti Maya, we think we're so elevated, we think we're so advanced, we think this, we think that, oh, you know, I've been practicing devotional service for 6 months, now I'm pure devotee. When I first came to the temple, I remember thinking, all these other devotees were pure devotees, some of them had been around for, 6 months, a year, something like that. And then, after some time, you go through this whole thing, and think, yeah, I'm really advanced now, I've been here for a year or 6 months or whatever, I'm becoming very advanced. Then you go further and further and further, and you start to realize, wow, I've got a long way to go. And that's the thing, as we become more advanced in devotional service, we actually realize how far we've got to go. And the more advanced we become, the more we realize how far we have got to go. Because we start to get a better perception of what advancement in devotional service means. It means Trinada, Peace, and Chenata, Uriva, Amanina, Manadina, Kitani, Siddhartha. We see that, like an advanced Vaishnava is one who has no false ego. He's always looking to serve others. He's humble, tolerant. I mean, Prabhupada was so tolerant. Incredible tolerance. And I've seen other Vaishnavas so tolerant. Remember one time I was in, I think it was Vrindavan, maybe 10 years ago. And, the devotees were going to distribute the Agri water after the Agri. There's one Maharaj there, and I can't remember which Maharaj it was. And this devotee was obviously thinking in his mind that he'd give this Maharaj some extra mercy. So he came and just tipped all the remaining Agri water in the pot on the Maharaj's head. And I think there was more in the pot than he thought there was. It just all started to run down over the Maharaj's face and down the side of his head. So the Maharaj just tolerated it. So obviously he's made advancement in devotional service, but he can tolerate some things like that. And we see that the material nature is going to send us so many different tests and trials and tribulations. And we need to learn to tolerate these things. Because as Krishna explains that in the Gita to Arjuna, a very important verse, he says to Arjuna, but the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress. We've seen that, we're experiencing that all the time. The happiness and distress are coming and going. He says they're just like the appearance and disappearance of summer and winter seasons. And what can you do about it? This is supposed to be summer. Here I am, I've got a t-shirt, a kurta, a jumper, a chadar. It's still my feet are cold. Welcome to Melbourne. But what can you do? Are we going to go around and complain about it? Try and make the various arrangements to change it and stuff? No, just tolerate it, because there's actually nothing you can do about it. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time, because I was born in Melbourne, but I went away and I came back after about 15 years. And I remember the first time when I came back, I was speaking to a girl, and said, you don't like the weather in Melbourne? Wait 5 minutes, you will. It's constantly changing. So it's like the appearance and disappearance of summer and season. Happy and distress, it's the same thing. Constantly changing. Is it? One minute you're happy, next minute you're sad, next minute you're angry, next minute you're this. It's constantly changing. And what does Krishna advise Arjuna? He says, he says one must learn to tolerate it without being disturbed. So tolerating is one thing, but without being disturbed. So this is the sign of someone who's making advancement progress. So it's as they tolerate these things, but not they tolerate the injuries. That's not really tolerating this without being disturbed. So and so is doing this to me, and they're really, they're a horrible person, this and that, but I'll tolerate it. No, without being disturbed. We just understand that this is just a working of material nature. This is due. There's a very nice purport Prabhupada gives in the 12th chapter of the Gita. It's either verse 6 or 7. And he quotes that verse from the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is spoken by Lord Brahma. Is it that day in the compound street, Susan explained all over Johnny, he got up to come back home. He got up to leave the other night, he stayed, he did the yoga and keep my days to go and back. And basically the verse explained that, the body who's, suffering reactions, patiently suffering reactions of his past behavior, patiently suffering all these things that come along, realizing they're simply reactions to his past misdeeds. He says, he actually surely becomes, and all the while he's offering respectful obeisances to the Lord in his heart, he surely becomes eligible for liberation. And he uses this phrase, goyabak. So goyabak actually means inheritance. And so it's like, when one is a good son or a good daughter, etc., they serve their parents and stuff like that, their parents now, they get the inheritance. So in the same way, if one is just serving Krishna patiently, and appreciate all these things that happen to me, they're just the results and reactions of my past misdeeds. And Prabhupada explains this purport in the 12th chapter. He says, but actually Krishna has, out of his kindness, has reduced these things to a token. I should be suffering so much more than what I am, but Krishna out of his kindness. And we see, you look at another verse, they suffer grievously. I just left Bombay, a few weeks I left Bombay after these attacks happened in Bombay. And some of these people were obviously suffering a very, very hellish situation. And it's just like you're walking down the street and someone shoots you, maybe they're not completely killed or anything. A very, very difficult situation. But devotees, generally speaking, we see that the suffering is there. It's not because we become devotees that nothing happens, that all of a sudden all the karma stops. But the devotee's understanding that I should be actually suffering so much more than this, because this is the nature of this material world. It's a place of suffering. That's what it's here for. It's to help us to understand that we're not this body, to help us understand that I'm not the controller, I'm not the enjoyer, I'm Krishna's servant. So the devotee understanding that Krishna's making these arrangements, he thinks, yes, I should suffer so much more, but Krishna, out of his humble kindness, has reduced this just to a token, just to remind me that I'm not this body, that I'm his servant. So, and it uses this term, doyabak, so that if the devotee is actually, patiently, serving Krishna, offering obeisance to Krishna, and tolerating these the various inconveniences, then this liberation, jivetiyo mukti pade, means this liberation, achieving the lotus feet of Krishna, sadoyabak. It becomes his rightful claim, it becomes the heir to the kingdom of God. Just simply by following the process of devotional service, simply by developing these qualities of patience and tolerance and stuff like that, then these things become our rightful claim. And just the last sentence. The Lord manifested such uniquely attractive women through his own mystic potency. He didn't have to buy anything, he didn't have to go to the shop, it just came out of his body. What comes out of our body? It's called mala. Exhalations, stirring, neural sweat, eye, the stuff in the nose, we call it sleep, nose, phlegm, mucus, saliva, stuff out of your ears, wax from ears. And what comes from the Lord's body? Hundreds and thousands of beautifully attractive women are coming out, and universes are coming out, and all the living entities are coming out, and all these wonderful manifestations. It's just like sometimes when it's really hot, we're working hard, we sweat. Some people sweat. I don't sweat so much. Probably because I'm lazy. But anyhow, we sweat. And the sweat's smelling. When the Lord lies down, when Karnabhakshaya Vishnu, he lies down on a nanta chase. And actually, no, it's like Gavadhakshaya Vishnu, he lies down on a nanta. And there's no ocean at that point. And he sweats. Right? And this universe we're in, right? Anyone know how big the globe is? How big the cross is on the inside? Anyone know the distance from one side of the universe to the other? 2 billion miles. Right? And the Lord lies down on a nanta. And he sweats. And he fills the globe half full of water with his perspiration. Imagine that. Lying down on the couch in the mansion, sweating, and half filling the room with sweat. How depleted would your body be? Because, see, that's the difference. We have a material body, it's very finite. Krishna has a transcendental body and it's infinite. There is no limit to it. There's no limit to what comes out. What he can do with it. How many manifestations is it? He's manifesting so many unlimited forms. There's a verse in the Bhagavatam where it describes like it's just like waves in the ocean, just they come. You know, you just go down here and you watch, and the waves just come and they come and they come and they come and they come, and there's no end to them. You can't count them as so many. And the manifestations of Krishna are just like that. Krishna manifests in every single species of life. And he's not diminished by this manifestation in one bit. He's continuously coming. So it's nice to meditate, you know, when we read pastimes like this, to see the difference between Krishna and between ourselves, and to see how unlimited he is and the things that he can do. There's no end to what he does. Okay, so, if there's any questions here. No.
Just one curiosity. There is also servant of Krishna, and once we surrender to Krishna, then why is there no trouble in devotion?
Thing is we have various amounts of karma that are still there. It's just like Prabhupada describes, it's like you know, this set the time initiation of the guru takes the karma of the disciple. So it's described that it's just like when you pull a fan. So the fan, you know, it slows down but it doesn't stop, it keeps spinning. So the karma is like that. It's not like instantly that the karma is absorbed and you know the whole thing finishes. And also the thing is as well is how surrendered are we? Are we completely surrendered? Are we partially surrendered? If we're completely surrendered, then these things are understood to be directly under the control of the Supreme Personality, aren't they? If we're partially surrendered, then obviously Krishna is involved in that, but it's still there's some karma coming from past activities, but it's diminishing more and more. And as it describes in the next devotion, that there's six, from devotional service, six things come. So devotional service is, brings all auspiciousness. So even these things come, you know, there may be karmas coming or reactions of whatever coming, but it's still auspicious because for a devotee, this is simply an impetus to surrender to Krishna more. This is simply an impetus to think of Krishna more. So this is one way we can actually gauge our development of devotional service, is when these various sufferings come, how do I respond to them? Do I curse the true nature? Do I curse the person who's brought this karma? Or do I simply think, yes, this is just give me, you know, more understanding of how horrible this true nature is and how merciful Krishna is and how he takes shelter of Krishna more and more and more. Prabhupada actually told, what's his name? The tennis coach. I can't remember his name. Peter Verwosh, yeah. Prabhupada told Peter Verwosh that he said, do not hate the instrument of your karma. You know, because we get reactions in so many different ways, you know, for our past activities. And it's not like that, you know, that person is doing something to me which is beyond the control of material nature, or, you know, like they're doing something independent. No, everything that's happening to me is a result of my past activities. It doesn't matter what it is, how minute, how, you know, insignificant, or how big these things are. This is all coming to me due to my past activities. So this is the essential thing, is we need to understand that this is coming about by my creation. My activities have caused that. So whether it's coming through the demigods, whether it's coming from another devotee, whether it's coming from some non-devotee, whatever the cause, whatever the manifestation, I'm the cause of that because it's happening to me. If it's happening to someone else, then they're the cause of that. And so, whether it's coming through demigods or whatever, we need to understand that and then appreciate how Krishna is diminishing these things out of kindness. Just to remind me that I'm not this body, just to remind me that I'm suffering here in this material world, just to remind me that I'm his eternal servant. And if I take shelter of him, I can go back to Godhead and I won't have to deal with these tribulations anymore. You know, suffering is my understanding of this, suffering is an essential element of being in this material world, because if we didn't suffer, we might want to stay here. But the fact we're suffering helps us to realize these things are not this body. A little bit loud, I can't quite hear.
In the Isha Upanishad, it's mentioned that the whole Om Bhulam Panasya. So everything is emanating from God and it's perfect. So the question comes in my mind is that we see today's world as so much like these bad things happening. So if the material world is still coming from, like, we, if we go to the basic instructions and everything is emanating from Krishna. So if it is perfect, then why there are like dualities and why there are three modes of material nature basically? You have so much of problems.
I'll give you an example. Take a banana. I like bananas, I really like them a lot. And you go to India, you go to Mysore, and the bananas are so tasty. They're all different sizes. I think you get 20 or 30 different types of bananas in India. Plantains and all different types of things. And particularly you get these small ones, like we call them lady fingers, and they're really sweet and really tasty. Okay, so that's Mysore. And they just let them grow. They just grow everywhere. They don't try to do anything with them. They just let them grow and eat them. Simple as that. And actually, practically every single thing that comes from banana tree in India. I make this really nice subject called matcha, which is the banana flavor. They chop it really fine, really, really tasty subject. Anyhow, so let's come back to the West. Now, probably in about 1995, 1996, you had all these big companies come from South America, and they took over all the banana industry in Australia. And they started to breed all these bananas, like do all this genetic modification of the bananas so that they'd all be the same size, so it'd be really easy for packaging. Yeah? And so you get, like we got these bananas last week, and I tell you, they were this long, they were gigantic. Absolutely no taste. Useless things, they're probably not even good for compost. You see, as soon as they start to meddle, as soon as the jiva starts, the way Krishna does it's nice, why don't you just leave it alone? It works really well. The bananas taste good, just let the things grow. You don't need to do anything to them. But no, just so that, just for packaging, so we can standardize the boxes we put them in. Yeah? And it's bizarre. It's bizarre that they're doing something like that, just to standardize the boxes, Or like with strawberries, We want to make them really big, so we pump them full of hormones. Yeah, because people buy the big ones, the red ones. Yeah? Absolutely tasteless. Yeah? But you get ones that grow naturally, very tasty. Yeah? So, the more the jiva interferes, if you look at the weather, what's going on in the world right now? They talk about global warming, etc., etc. We have a further understanding. This is the result of simple activities. Because they're trying to enjoy, they're pumping more and more heat into the atmosphere, and the heat is just going up and up and up, and it's having all sorts of catastrophic effects. Cyclones, typhoons, flooding, earthquakes, etc., etc. And it's going to increase. The more they try to enjoy, the more they're performing simple activities, the more they forget Krishna, the more these things are going to happen. So the system that Krishna gave is perfect. The Vedic system is perfect. If we follow the Vedic system, our life becomes perfect. But if we try to make up our own system, if we try to see the material nature, purusha praktikosti, purusha praktikosti, bunki praktikosti, kananam guru sanghosa, sad asad jani jambasu. The living entity, he's trying to enjoy material nature. This forces him to take various births. He meets with, he takes birth in various auspicious and inauspicious species of life because of this desire to enjoy material nature. So the system is perfect. It does what it's designed to do, as long as we don't meddle. But because living entities, particularly in this day and age, particularly in Kali Yuga, the scientists, etc., they think they're the controllers. They think that they can do so many different things. Like all this genetic modification they're doing for for living entities and stuff like that. Yeah, and the human bodies are just getting weaker and weaker. You hear about children these days dying of cancer. I remember when I was maybe about 18, 17, no, 16, and a friend of the people I was living with, he had cancer, and he was 35 years old, and everyone was shocked. He was so young, and he had cancer. It used to be like an old person's disease, and he was 35, and he had cancer. Now you hear of children with cancer. That's the result of Kali Yuga. As it progresses further and further, as people get further and further implicated in things like these things get worse and worse and worse. Because of simple activities. That's all it is.
Well, his question is, if there's only bad things, how can it be perfect?
That's the answer, because they're disrupting the system. It is perfect. But because they're disrupting the system. Because people are meddling.
But how is that perfect?
Because it's responding to the input. It's just like if you have something spinning, right? Like, you know, like with a bicycle wheel, the only thing that keeps the bicycle up is the gyroscopic action of the wheel, right? So, and you can take that wheel spinning and you can put it on its axle like that and it'll spin. Poke it like that and it starts to wobble. Yeah? So that's what's happening. The earth is wobbling. Because of the input of these materialistic people, because the sins are acting. So it's a perfect system. It's completely, you know, enclosed, etc. And it's functioning perfectly. Because this is happening, it's responding in a particular way. And just like you watch material nature, the way it responds when things happen. It's responding to the input.
Also, where is that?
Yeah.
So it's also in the instruction to
everything destroyed. So, Jesus cuts through the material nature, anyone's going to enjoy it. So, Krishna's not allowing them to enjoy it. Yeah. Yeah, more, yeah, it's a fact. The more you try to enjoy the material nature, the more you get implicated in the outcomes and the different sufferings and things. The system is perfect and it has a particular purpose. You know, the material nature is not put here for us to enjoy. Material nature is here to help us to realize where Krishna's eternal servant. So if we go against that, then it creates disruption. If we understand what the system is for and we apply ourselves, as I mentioned, you know, follow the Vedic system, understand what you know, matter is for. And actually, matter is meant for serving Krishna. And that's the perfect use of material nature. But if we're trying to use it to serve our own senses, then they become, then there's disruptions. And that's what we're experiencing. The whole thing is disrupted right now.
Getting to perfect, we still recommend that there are four miseries of material existence,
yeah,
which are basically designed to remind us that this is not a place to be perfect in, because it's a place of imperfection. So perfect exists in that it's meant to rectify us.
Yeah, that's what's for. It was perfectly designed for intelligent living entities. For non-intelligent, they'll never understand that. But for intelligent living entities to understand that this is to rectify my deviant nature. So if we take that, then we'll get the benefit. But otherwise, just increase suffering. The forecast for Kali Yuga is bleak. Don't think it's a place we're going to enjoy. Just look, you know, economic disaster, environmental disaster, etc., etc. Bleak forecast for Kali Yuga. Don't expect you're going to enjoy here too much. A little bit is there to help foster the illusion, but don't expect too much. Okay? Kantarachana Bhagavatam ki Shri Prabhupada ki Samavesa Bhakti Vrinda ki Jain Prabhupada. Thank you.